Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm going to tell you about the subject which is a little far from the beaten path of most physicists, but nonetheless hope to convince you is still quite interesting, which is how to look at some problems in a field roughly called biological pattern formation from the perspective of a physicist who thinks about non-equilibrium, non-linear physics. And so, in order to do that, you know, there are, you know, an infinite number of possible biological systems to pick to try to just give you a basic sort of guidelines as to how one is going to try to do that. So to be specific, we're going to look at this type of program in a specific context, the context of bacterial colony patterns, which you'll see pictures of in a few moments. So the outline of what I'm going to tell you, I'll give you a very, very brief introduction to pattern formation as a whole. That's really not what I want to spend my time talking about. I want to really spend my time talking about what are the specific challenges that come up when one is going to work on biological examples of that. And then we'll talk about bacterial colonies, we'll talk about branching structures, chiral structures, vortex structures, and try to put this all into some general lessons and ideas, and that's going to be a challenge for me and hopefully successfully met by this talk. And thank various people, Eshel Ben Jacob, who's here, and other people I've worked with over the years on this particular system, Inon Cohen, Dave Kessler, Walter Rappel. Okay. So the perfunctory, you know, two-slide introduction to pattern formation in non-living systems, and this is a area that's really, you know, sort of flourished in the last, let's say, two decades, maybe two and a half decades by now. The study is really focused on looking at how nonlinear processes in physics or chemistry or both can give rise to spatial structures. They can be growing spatial structures. This is the sort of emblem of the field from way back when, the growing snowflake crystal. They can be dynamic patterns. This is actually an image of a chemical oxidation state on a platinum catalyst. This is a high-tech version of the experiment that goes on in all of your cars, in which a platinum surface takes carbon monoxide and converts it to carbon dioxide. And if you take a single crystal under very nice, carefully controlled conditions and image, for example, the carbon monoxide concentration on the surface, you'll find these great rotating patterns. This work was done by groups in Germany over the last 10 years or so. And this field, you know, one of the things that makes it exciting and interesting is it really is, you know, everybody says this, but it's really true. This is a cooperative endeavor involving theory, experiment, and computer simulation. And, you know, we had a whole bunch of talks here about a month or so ago on what are some of the interesting physical systems that one is thinking about in this area. Just to give you, as I said, a brief introduction, there are material science issues. For example, this is the crumpling. This is the crumpling of the edge of a sort of torn piece of tape, and this relates to fracture physics and ductile versus brittle behavior. There's a lot of work going on this, a lot of it here, in fact, in the physics department. There's also chemical waves. This is an example of a chemical reaction where you get these waves that propagate to the right, but the waves, instead of being sort of nice linear things, are broken up into these spots. And so this is some new particular systems, some new questions here. There are also more traditional systems, convection, fluid mechanics, looking at nonlinear structures. So there's a whole bunch of things going on, and I don't mean to give you a serious introduction to any of them, but I just want to frame the question of, given that all these things are going on, why have a number of us in this field, and I might even say an increasing number of us, although one can argue about how to count, why have we gone and tried to take our knowledge and gone over to the biological system? So I've given you three reasons. You know, maybe reason zero has to do with funding, but I won't put that up there. Reason one is really true. If you go, you know, you go out in the scientific world as a whole, biology, according to the biologists and almost everybody else, is undergoing some tremendous revolution. And roughly speaking, that revolution is trying to move it closer to what a physicist would recognize as a science. In other words, where there are theories that make predictions, there are quantitative experiments that try to compare some out of those theories. So biology is trying to move towards what physics and chemistry recognize as being a harder science, and, you know, can physics help? So this is, you know, the first part, which I think is a motivation for some of us. A second motivation is that when you work on these pattern formation systems, especially if you're a theorist, every once in a while you come across the fact that you really would like, if you could, make predictions about experiments involving the interactions of constituents of your materials. You'd really like to be able to control those interactions. So if you're looking at a crystal growth pattern, you'd really like to be able to say things like a critical parameter governing the shape of that snowflake is the something having to do with the underlying crystal structure, which of course is determined by water molecule interactions. You can't tune the interaction between water molecules in the real world very much. You can change the temperature, you can add impurities, but there's just a limit to how much you can do. Once you start talking about biological constituents, when you talk about the fundamental units of your pattern not being individual molecules with relatively fixed interactions, but being individual cells, or even one level below, individual large complexes of protein molecules, then we do have the ability, technically, to change the interactions between the constituents via all the technology that's been developed in the last couple of decades. And so from a practical perspective, the additional complexity you have to deal with might be balanced by the additional opportunities for actually creating and tuning your interactions in a way that's just not possible in a physical system. Okay, that's the second possible reason. I think this talk is going to argue in some sense for the third possible reason, which is really a question of science, which is that I just told you that what we're going to be discussing are patterns where the constituents are biological pieces. What are biological pieces? Well, there can be patterns involving organisms, patterns involving cells, patterns involving different proteins inside a cell. These are obviously much more complicated than simple molecules. In fact, I just told you they're sufficiently complicated that you can, in some sense, engineer their interactions if you know enough about them. So the question is, does this actually lead to new physics? Is there some set of patterns, some set of pattern formation phenomena that somehow make use of the intrinsically more complex set of ingredients here? What do those additionally new pattern formation principles take? Is there something new to be learned about pattern formation, about the way structures can organize in space and time in the world by looking at biological systems? So that's the perspective I'm going to try to convey to you as we go along. Now, as I said, the system we're going to discuss, we could pick many, but this is the one that, you know, sort of the nicest visually. So we're going to discuss bacterial colony patterns. So just to get you oriented, this is the workhorse of the field, the Petri dish, where what you do is, you know, there's some material just sitting in this Petri dish, usually agar, which is just some gel, and there's some amount of nutrient that's been dissolved into this material. And on day one, you come into the lab and you inoculate some bacteria into the center of this. The bacteria eat all the food that's available locally, so they have to somehow move outward, and they divide, they move outward, and what you see here is a colony that has, you know, large numbers, you know, billions and billions in the vernacular of bacteria. It's not 10 to the 23rd molecules, they're not, you know, it's not the same as Avogadro's number, but it's still a very large number, and you create these rather intricate looking nice branched patterns. This particular one, the sort of canonical branching one, was originally seen in a Japanese group around 1989 or 1990 or so. This particular picture, and in fact many of the pictures I'll be showing you, is from the lab of Eshelb and Jacob. And what we'll see and try to understand this is exactly why you get this branching. So of course keep in mind that in this system the growth will be limited by diffusion of nutrients. And again, generically I will call these bacteria bacillus, although there's a complicated issue of exactly what the species are and whatever. I don't want to get into that. That's irrelevant for purpose here. Now, when you get started thinking about that pattern, in fact, that pattern was originally published as a bacterial analog of this pattern. This pattern, you know, stolen many years ago from Wen's webpage, is one of the sort of simplest workhorses of the field of pattern formation in physical systems. It's a simulation of a process called diffusion-limited aggregation. The colors here just refer to the times at which the different particles actually added to this aggregate. They're not anything intrinsic, they're just meant to look, they just look nice. It shows you that this thing grows. First this grows, and then these grow, and then the yellow grows, and then the red grows. The growth algorithm is you start out with a single particle over there at the center, you take a random walker, wanders around, it sticks when it hits that particle, then you take another random walker, wanders around, sticks when it hits the particle, you do that 10 million times, and you get these nice pictures. And a lot is known about the picture, but I should say that from the point of view of the fundamentals of pattern formation, there's still open questions as to exactly how to understand this process, even though there has been progress in the last couple of years. Now, the idea for this pattern in the original Witten-Sander paper, and in subsequent systems that have been shown to be related to this, is that branching is a result of the fact that growth is diffusion limited. So the idea is that if you think about the structure, let's think about the structure in its blue phase over here, and now I take my next random walker, it wanders along, comes in, and I ask, where is it typically going to hit this pattern over here? And the answer is, well, the probability distribution for that problem of hitting a sort of random absorbing boundary by a walker is sort of like solving Laplace's equation with a boundary condition of the blue being an equipotential. If you do that, you discover the probability is always highest at the tips. There's very little probability that the walker is going to be able to walk in here. So the yellow is all new growth at the tips of the blue, and the system just keeps branching. It just keeps growing more and more, always at the tips, and that's what accounts for this overall branching growth. So this is a, when you look at this, and I said the people who originally published that pattern, the branching pattern of the bacteria, immediately had this in mind. They said, aha, this is some bacterial realization of that. Now, so fine. So how do we get started? How do we get started thinking about this in a more serious way? I mean, the first step is to identify, you know, we have a bacterial pattern that looks interesting, and we have something that looks like a physical template for understanding that. So how do we get started? Well, the first step is trying to take more seriously the idea of this relationship between the physical pattern I just showed you, and I didn't show you any, you know, physical realizations of that pattern in the real world, but you can believe me that there are quite a number. How do I check that this connection that I've made is not just, gee, I have a picture here and a picture here and they look the same, so therefore they must be similar. How do I check that that things are deeper than that, that there's really some connection dynamically between the way in which the structure is formed in the physical system, which where I know what it is because I just define it, versus the way the structure is formed in the biological system? And if you think about, I mean, if you think that that's a trivial question, you can, historically, there was what I tend to call the Turing pattern fiasco, which you know, is perhaps a strong way to put it, but historically, people spent a lot of time comparing, you know, stripe and spot patterns in biological systems. These are patterns on the surface of tropical fish or butterflies or various other examples of that, and created Turing patterns, which are certain classes of patterns in reaction diffusion systems, and said, aha, the two things look similar, so therefore there must be some underlying mechanism that somehow creates these Turing patterns in these biological systems. And at least in the cases that one has been able to understand so far, for example, you know, stripes and Drosophila embryos, I think this has turned out to be just totally a red herring, and therefore one was misled just by looking at the pattern. One really had to go and ask, how do we know it's really true? So I'm going to answer that question in two ways. So the first question is, if we made this prediction, we need to understand why mechanistically do we think the growth dynamics of the bacteria have something to do with this diffusion limited mechanism? And then the flip side of that is, once I make that hypothesis and I identify various dynamics, what predictions can I make based on this connection that I can then test experimentally? So let's do that. So the first question is, how can I understand dynamically, or you know, how can I begin to make a dynamic model of the bacteria growth in order to understand why there might be this connection that's beyond the level of just, you know, they look the same. So if you take a closer look at the branches, this is different magnifications of the branches. Here, you know, this is a little bit blurry on the screen, but actually the little blotches here are the individual bacteria to give you some idea of the scale of the branch compared to the scale of the constituents here. And what you notice is that the branches are very sharply defined, and here you see it directly, that there's regions where there are bacteria, and then there are regions where there are no bacteria, and there's a very sharp transition from one to the other. Now, why is that? Well, it turns out that these bacteria have a very hard time moving individually on this surface. So now I need to tell you a little bit about the experiments. The experiments are done in such a way as to make life hard for the bacteria. If you make life easy for the bacteria, if you give them a very soft surface to swim on, and you give them a lot of food, then they react by being boring. So, you know, they just spread out in a circle, and okay, fine. You know, you get a lot of bacteria, you can go and do various biochemistry analysis of that bacteria, so it's convenient, but it doesn't show you anything interesting. So your way that you get something interesting is by making life difficult. How did you make life difficult? Well, first of all, there's not that much food, so they really do have to move out in order to grow. They can't just sit there and just eat their heart's content for weeks on end. And the agar surface is made hard, which is just controlled by how much water you put in this gel, and therefore it's actually quite hard for them to move on the surface. In fact, it's so hard for them to move on the surface that if you take a single bacteria and just put it on the surface, it can't move itself. So individually they don't move. However, collectively, they do move, and the way they move collectively, it's not completely understood in detail, but what seems to be the case is that they secrete some type of lubricant fluid, and here is the sort of envelope of this lubricant fluid, and within this sort of lubricated region, there is enough water, and they can't swim. So they need enough of them to sort of create the environment that they themselves can move in. You already begin to see that the system is a little more interesting than just, you know, simple diffusion, but okay. So they can do that, and that's how they actually move on the surface. Now, if you take that ingredient and just make a very simple dynamical model, show you some equations, then you would say the following, and this is the simplest dynamical model, which tries to incorporate what I just told you. So the simplest model you can make is you would say, okay, there's concentration of bacteria, that's A. There's concentration of nutrient B. This term just means that in order for the bacteria to reproduce, it needs nutrients. So the simplest way you would say that is this thing will grow exponentially at a rate determined by the nutrient. And that's good enough for small nutrient. The large nutrient that obviously saturates, but we care about the small nutrient limit in this case. So let's just make the simplest possible equation. And similarly, you know, when the bacteria eat the nutrient disappears, the nutrient diffuses, that's fine, but the bacteria don't quite diffuse. They actually have this more complicated collective motion, which you can try to be more specific about, but at the very least, you have to assume that the effective motility goes down as the concentration goes down. So unlike the fact that, you know, simple diffusion means each one can walk independently, here the simplest thing you can do to accommodate this new physiochemical effect is the statement that the effective motility here would go to zero as the concentration goes to zero. Now, it turns out you can do a simple calculation, which I won't do, but I'll just tell you about. That's interesting. Figures of, oh, okay, they come up one at a time. Interesting. So it turns out that the problem of that equation, that type of equation of bacteria growing in response to nutrient and the bacteria only having this collective motility, gives rise to some very interesting phenomena that basically explains why the bacteria have a branching instability. So I don't know how much of this I want to go through. This is an interesting story. The interesting story is that if you solve the problem with linear diffusion, this was done a long time ago by Fisher and Kolmogorov in different contexts, what you get is, with linear diffusion, you get, this is now the inside of the colony, this is the outside of the colony, and you get some very sort of smooth-looking front from one to the other.
Linear diffusion means D is a constant.
Yeah, D is constant, thanks, yes. And this system, if you solve this and go and plug it in and figure out what's going on, has no instability. There's no linear instability of the growth equations. Therefore, there's no branching. In other words, linear instability means you start growing a planar front or a circular front, depending on your geometry of the bacteria. You make a perturbation, and you ask, will that perturbation grow? Will the fact that the growth is limited by nutrient diffusive flux, will that cause an instability like this DLA pattern or not? You can do the calculation. If you assumed linear diffusion with this type of front, the answer would be no. However, if you put in this nonlinear diffusion, you get a sharp front. This is now the front. It goes to zero exactly at some point with a sharp boundary here due to the nonlinearity. And the answer to this front is yes. If you go and do this calculation and you actually discover this system does have a branching instability. So you can identify in a crude mathematical model what is the source of the branching instability. It's nutrient limited growth, of course, but in a slightly different context, in a context where you need this sharp front, which is created via this collective motion. Okay. Now,
I'm sorry, Herbie, is that unstable for all wavelengths?
No, it's stable eventually again. It has some spectrum, which I didn't show you. But no, it's not unstable for all wave numbers. It eventually is cut off again. We'll talk about that in a second in a different context. Now, I said there were sort of two things. So the first thing you wanted to do under the why-do theory is you want to identify why is it that you think dynamically the mechanism governing this growth really is in the same class as the mechanism governing diffusion-limited growth in non-biological contexts. And the second thing you want to do is you want to use that to make predictions, even in the absence of a very detailed model. So this is an art form, because normally in physics, in the best physics, we have a very detailed model, maybe a fully detailed model, maybe only, a semi-quantitative model, but we try to make quantitative predictions, and the test of the theory is, can we make a real quantitative prediction? Well, here we have a problem, which is that I just showed you a very, very simple caricature, which gets you sort of going in the right direction, but it's not enough to make a fully quantitative prediction. How do I make predictions and see if it works or not? So you need to make predictions that somehow depend only on the mechanism that you've proposed and are independent of knowing all the precise underlying details. Well, how can you do that? Well, let me just try to give you some examples, one which is relatively simple and the other which is more deep. The one which is relatively simple is that one of the things that we learned over many years and many people working on patterns in diffusion-limited growth is that they don't come in one variety. They come in several different varieties depending on various trade-offs between diffusion constants, the range over which you have these unstable wave vectors that Lars just asked me about, other trade-offs, which we'll talk about in a second. And so the idea emerged there would be some type of non-equilibrium phase diagram where, as a function of the different parameters controlling the system, you would get certain types of patterns, and then as you varied across boundaries, you would get transitions from one type of pattern to the other. So you can do that in these bacterial systems. So these are all different parameter values. What you're supposed to notice is that within a given plate, these patterns, they're not exactly the same. This is not exactly a deterministic process, but this is clearly different than that. It's clearly different than that. It's clearly different than that. So there's a reproducibility of the pattern at a given set of parameter values, but yet, as you change parameter values, you get large-scale transformations from one type of pattern to the other, and you can try to draw some type of phase diagram, and yes. Yes.
It's true that the term of reproducibility, but right now only in organics with the completion.
I didn't say it was eat.
Can maintain such reproducibility. The two plates at the bottom were two different plates. In both experiences, but every time study,
I'll go back.
Very, very hard.
It's hard, but this is right.
It is possible, so, the fact that it is, but
Well, we're familiar with the idea that there's some things only Russians can do, but they usually don't involve bacteria. They usually involve mathematics. But in any case, yeah, so I should have said, I mean, these are different conditions, and these are plates grown on different days and different, you know, whatever, but under the same conditions. And again, you see the level of, this is the level of reproducibility you can get if you're careful, which you have to be careful. Okay, so just to change, you know, so that's led to the idea of the phase diagram. This is actually from the Japanese group rather than from Eschel's lab. And what you see is just sort of a rough diagram in terms of the two parameters that one could control experimentally. This is the nutrient concentration. This is 1 over the agar concentration. The sort of branching, maximal branching pattern is when you have low nutrient and the agar is very hard, and then you get other things that happen. If you have more nutrient, you tend to get round things. If you, in this region, is something else that's new, which I'm not going to describe. So the idea is you can draw this type of phase diagram and compare it to even simplified models and see if you're at least getting close to predictions that make sense. So that's okay. A more interesting or deeper level of prediction has to do with something that was discovered 20 years ago, but is still, in my mind, a extremely interesting example of how how sort of mathematics of nonlinear systems can really provide surprises to you. So, the second thing I want to talk about is we're going to be able to make a prediction about controlling the bacterial pattern via making a small perturbation. So let me tell you a story about something that was discovered, as I said, 20 years ago. And it's connected to the fact that, you know, very often, if you look at macroscopic equations of motion, you discover that these equations of motion are well-defined under some circumstances, and under other circumstances lead to singularities. So in our system, the diffusive processes that drive the instability tend to drive you to getting more and more branched things, and then eventually something has to happen on a smaller length scale in order to prevent the system from just reaching a singularity where, you know, the thing blows up. I tried to think of an analog. Actually, I was interested to learn over the last couple of years that in string theory, there is an analog of this, which is the question of whether string theory, either in its classical form or its quantum form, would be able to get rid of the Hawking-Penrose type of space-time singularities in black holes or the Big Bang or whatever.
We should have come to the lunch seminar.
Well, okay, good. So this is an active area of research in string theory, which even more active than, you know, I could have imagined. And so let's sort of trace through the logic of what this thing does in a simple example, which we can solve motivated by diffusion-limited growth. Well, in diffusion-limited growth, it turns out the simplest model for describing the snowflake-type pattern is this equation. Let me just tell you what this equation is. It's a very nice, simple geometrical equation. It says, just for the purposes of illustration, imagine a two-dimensional world where the boundary that you're describing is a one-dimensional interface, and you can try to do this in one higher dimension, but it doesn't matter. Let's stick to two dimensions. This is just the normal velocity of growth somewhere along that interface. This is the curvature, and if I just stick to the moment for Vn equal the curvature, that's an example of totally unstable growth, okay? Because the more and more curved I'd make my surface, the faster and faster it would grow, that system would reach a singularity in finite time. Now, I don't want it to reach a singularity in finite time, and I know that the actual system in crystal growth has parameters, like the surface energy of the system, that prevent it from getting arbitrarily curved. And what that does in this model equation is it provides a regularization of that that's due to what's happening on a smaller length scale. So the fact it's a smaller length scale means that this enters as a higher derivative term, and therefore this parameter officially is a singular perturbation of the equations. Now, okay, so this equation, kappa plus gamma d squared kappa d s squared, is well defined. And now just for you know, fun, we're going to include one more physical effect, which is we're going to say that underlying the crystal growth of the snowflake is there's really a crystal, which means that for a given external field, the growth rate is going to be modulated by the fact that there's really a crystal, and really things have to crystallize. Crystals are not rotationally symmetric, and if I had a fourfold crystal, I would get something which would modulate this rule by just cosine 4 theta or 6 theta if I had hexagonal. Now, this equation has some really interesting properties that, which I want to try to relate to you. So, if you set gamma equals 0, I already told you the problem is ill-posed, which means it reaches a singularity at finite time. If you neglect that, if you just say to yourself, well, let me anyway look for just steady solutions of this equation, well, the sickness of being ill-posed as an initial value problem translates into the statement that if you look at just the steady state patterns that are possible, you get patterns for arbitrary values of the velocity. So the velocity can be whatever it wants, and the way to see it is you can just take this equation. If I start integrating from the tip, theta of 0, theta, I should say, is the normal angle. So if I write, so the curvature, of course, is just the derivative of the angle with respect to the arc length. I have a simple first-order ODE. If I start from the tip where the angle at some defined arc length of 0 is 0, then I just automatically, in this equation, and I reach that the angle at infinity reaches pi over 2 in a smooth way. So I get some smooth moving solution that has the feature that any velocity is possible. Now, what happens when I put this gamma back in? Well, now the equation near infinity here has this extra higher order derivative term. It's a singular perturbation. That allows new possible modes of the problem. The new possible modes of the problem are things that are crazy. They're things that oscillate with a wavelength that goes inversely as the square root of this gamma function, which, you know, is, well, the wave vector that goes inversely as the square root of gamma. That's crazy. That's a very high frequency oscillation in the pattern, which is not what I want. So what I have to do is I have to adjust my initial conditions, which now I have a third order equation. So now if I want to integrate from this point, I need to tell you also theta prime, theta double prime. I need to fix those values to ensure that I actually reach a stable fixed point at infinity. Well, when you do the calculation of what you have to set these things equal to, you discover that theta prime of 0 has to be non-zero, which means there has to be a cusp on the top because I'm integrating one way, and if I integrate the other way, I'd get the opposite sign. And the cusp magnitude is a non-perturbative effect of gamma, so it's absent to all orders in perturbation theory, but nonetheless is non-zero. And it has a prefactor, which is a function of the velocity over the anisotropy to the 7/4 power, which has various zeros. So now I get a system which says I'm not going to be able to find a simple solution of this equation unless there's some special condition on the velocity, and furthermore, that special condition on the velocity involves directly this parameter epsilon, no matter how small epsilon is. So all this is mathematics, and it reaches an amazing conclusion, which you can implement in the bacterial system. The conclusion is that because of the nature of the instability in diffusion-limited growth, small perturbations, like the anisotropy, can totally reorder the macroscopic pattern. So this is now not a snowflake, this is now a bacteria colony. This is now when you do the same experiment, but you, I don't think you can quite see it here, where you etch a very sort of superficial set of grooves in the system, which six-fold symmetry, so you slightly bias the nutrient diffusion and the bacterial growth such that it's slightly higher along various six-fold axes, and you can convert the branching pattern, which is an unstable branching pattern, to this type of stable branching pattern from, as you see, in the analogous to the crystal growth snowflake pattern. So this, you know, this is meant to be, and here is, if you focus in on the tip, you see that this is actually a stable tip that then propagates at constant velocity. So the lesson of this exercise is that there are ways of testing simple assumptions about bacterial patterns, even in the absence of a full theory, because this type of mechanism is It's hard to prove that it's unique to this theory, but it's certainly a surprising prediction that came out of lots of work on this process in physical systems, and it isn't just going to happen by some accident of any branching pattern will do this. For example, I don't think it's been done, but we all know, if you look, there are beautiful movies on various websites of the growth of human kidneys that also look like a branching process. And my prediction is that that branching process has nothing to do with the fusion-limited growth. It has to do with a much more complicated genetic mechanism, and therefore, if one tried this trick, one would not get snowflake-shaped kidneys. But no one has done that, as far as I know. It's a prediction. Yes?
So this comes from the anisotropy.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Now, okay. So let's continue along this line of thinking about control of patterns. And I want to introduce what you can think of as a hierarchy of pattern control. So the one you showed before was the lowest level of the hierarchy, because what do? We had this pattern, this bacterial pattern, and by hand, we went in, we added a perturbation. The perturbation was a six-fold anisotropy, and we got a large change in the system because of this intrinsically nonlinear amplification of small effects due to cutoffs in the system. But it still was an intrinsic perturbation. Extrinsic. In other words, the bacteria didn't do it, we did it. Now, it turns out that there is another possibility, which is a slightly deeper level in the hierarchy, which I call control via an intrinsic but decoupled physical process. So, for example, let's just think about real crystal growth. In real crystal growth, there is a crystal lattice, there is a perturbation of the pattern which breaks the rotational symmetry. You do get snowflake crystals. That underlying crystal lattice is not imposed by us, the experimentalists, it's imposed by physics, but it's imposed by decoupled physics. There's a set of, you know, microscopic, you know, atomic scale physics that determines that water crystallizes into some hexagonal lattice with some structure out of the plane. That thing has nothing to do with diffusion limited growth. We can solve that problem, find the preferred crystal structure, and then that imposes a perturbation on the system. So it's an intrinsic but decoupled way of controlling the process. Now, the crystal growth example is familiar, at least to some class of people. I want to show another example which is a little less familiar, but has the same principle, which is this is a growth of a domain of phospholipid molecules on a liquid-air interface. Now, phospholipid molecules are like soap molecules. They like to sit on the surface between air and water, because they have sort of one polar end and one non-polar end, and they have various phases, and you can imagine, you know, taking a system that's in something like a gas phase and pressurizing it, and that's going to cause the growth of solid-like domains of the system, and this black is sort of like the solid-like domain. And the funny thing about it is, here you see this thing bending around to the right. This is for one-side-handedness of these chiral molecules. This is DPPPC, and I don't even remember what this DP, whatever, can't say it. This, which branch goes around the other side, is this one, where all the molecules are left-handed, and it just the same pattern just goes the other way. And then if you mix them to make a racemic mixture, then there is no broken symmetry. Both get incorporated, and now you see something where the tip seems to grow out symmetrically. So again, you know, the chemistry which caused these molecules to be chiral or not chiral is not something we've imposed. It's some underlying, you know, chemical bonding nature that created these molecules, but then that perturbation then governs what you see in terms of the pattern formation in this intrinsic but decoupled way. Now let's contrast that to what I call the next level. The next level is control via an intrinsic process, which nonetheless is coupled to the pattern formation mechanism. So how can I do that? Well, I've given you two examples, one of which is pretty well understood, the other one of which is not understood. So this is an experiment of something like crystal growth, but it's actually a fluid experiment. So it was known for at least 30 or 40 years, maybe more by now, that you can create a fluid analog of crystal growth by expanding a bubble of air into a viscous fluid. And you can go through the calculation, and the pressure plays the role of the temperature, and you know, mathematically it winds up being similar, with the one very big difference is that there's no intrinsic anisotropy in the system because we're talking about fluids. So the natural pattern you get when you do that looks like this sort of disordered looking pattern over here. Now, in an experiment done circa late 80s or so, people did the same normal experiment of pushing air into fluids, but instead of taking a normal fluid, they took a liquid crystal. A liquid crystal is a fluid in, you know, rheological sense, but where there's sort of a microscopically, there's an ordering of the molecule. So it's a fluid made out of long rod-like molecules, and there can be a simple liquid phase where the molecules are just tumbling randomly, and therefore there's no breaking of any orientational order, or there can be a pneumatic phase in which there's still a liquid, but nonetheless, all the molecules on average are pointing in the same direction. So there's a residual orientational ordering of the rods of the molecule. And now when you do that experiment over here, you see something that goes back and looks like the dendritic growth pattern with stable branches. Why is that? Well, people have made models of this and more or less explain this. What happens is, as you push the air out here, the flow pattern that you're creating in the liquid crystals is enough to induce a local ordering of this director field. So the system creates its own anisotropy. That it isn't intrinsic in this system, there is no underlying crystal here, but any tip that forms is able to sort of polarize its surroundings and self-consistently create something which allows it to move forward more simply than to move sideways, and allows for stabilization of this pattern that previously was only stabilized by an intrinsic or a lower level thing. So you can have a perturbation in the system that's created dynamically as part of the process. Yes, then. I'm not sure they know why it's hexagons. And you don't only get it, you can get fourfold also. It depends how hard you push. Because there's sort of, the initial instability in how hard you push determines how many fingers you get out, and then you can't get too many more than hexagons because otherwise they start interfering with each other. But you can get four and five, yeah. You can get electric fields. People have, there's people who, there is a significant number of people who have worked on this, including making models of it to show that it makes sense. Another example, which actually Oni Eshel showed me this during this meeting, is this is a chiral system, which is really remarkable because this is a racemic mixture of materials. But now what you see is that when it's crystallized, the main branch is somehow going to the left, the side branches are going to the right, and then these branches are going back to the left. So somehow, even though the mixture is, 50-50 left and right, somehow dynamically this, well, okay, but whatever. it's not 100%. And somehow the system somehow phase separates such that all these molecules here are going one way, all of those are going the other way, so there's some dynamic ordering that's taking place as part of the pattern formation process that is dynamic and therefore requires an extra degree of explanation. Now, all this is fine, and the real question I wanted to ask is, do bacteria make use of this more powerful control strategy? In other words, we know we can control the pattern, can they control the pattern? Okay, well the answer of course is yes, or otherwise I wouldn't be telling you. So here is just a more fanciful picture of this branching pattern, and what was discovered was that there can be this other pattern, which was called the chiral morphotype. This happens to be one of my favorite all-time pictures of these bacterial colonies. It's on my door of my office, in case you visit San Diego. And what you see here is, aside from the sort of artistic coloring scheme, what you see here is that the branches actually all sort of curl around to the left over here. This is really, some chiral symmetry breaking, which is eventually due to the, it's not a symmetry breaking. It isn't that they go left sometimes and right sometimes. Underlying the bacteria are various flagella that are handed, and in this phase, always biased it enough to give you turns to the left, or if you grow it upside down, it gives you turns to the right. So you can check that it's really using the symmetry allowed to it by the breaking of the molecular symmetry. Mm-hmm. Now, here is what it looks like if you look a little more closely. Not only can you get one pattern versus the other pattern, you can get transitions from one to the other. So here, you see, you know, this is a blow-up of a petri dish where starting back here somewhere it was growing in this branching manner. Somehow over here, something happened, and there's sort of a confused period where things are sort of sorting themselves out, and then eventually, out over there, the chiral one wins. So now you might ask, where did this chiral pattern come from? What is actually going on?
What did you mean by heritable?
Yeah. What? What did I mean by what? Oh, I didn't say that yet. I was going to say that on the next page. By heritable, you guys are too far ahead of me. By heritable is that if you take one of these and start a new plate, it goes into branching. You take one of these, start a new plate, it goes immediately into chiral.
One bacteria.
One bacteria, yeah.
One.
Really? Yeah, one.
One.
I mean, it's hard to, you know. What?
How does it remember?
Well, okay, so that's part of what's interesting, right? The answer is the bacteria has dynamically changed. So you'll see that in the next, so I was going to get to that.
The environment is completely the same, right?
Oh, this is one plate. Right. So this is one plate, and there are various conditions that seem to prefer this, and, you know, one might argue why this is preferred. So, for example, under certain conditions of hardness and food, these things seem to spread faster, and under other conditions, these things seem to spread faster. So what it seems like is that, you know, the simpler word to say is heritable. So by heritable, you mean something operational, which means that you take it, you put one on another plate, and it grows the chiral pattern immediately. Then you ask, well, what could be heritable? One possibility is a real change in the genome, a mutation. The other possibility is something which is perhaps maybe more likely or not, depending on your point of view. The other possibility is that there's some different state of the gene expression pattern that the system has gone over to. So gene expression patterns, which are, you know, dynamic, which that's part of the point, are their own dynamical systems. They have various fixed points, and this thing might be some way in which the gene expression pattern of the same genome has somehow been switched in a way that it can remember from generation to generation. Sort of epigenetic in the official language. Well, so that will have, yes, so, yeah, so the answer is yes, and that's one of the things that really has to be done, is figure out what is it. So, it's not a nucleus, it's a bacteria. So there's no nucleus. DNA is just sitting there. You can take out the DNA. It's testable. It's not untestable, but it just has not been elucidated. What is the change? You can do gene expression arrays. You can try to sequence it. Of course, no one's going to sequence all of this and all of that just for this experiment. We still haven't reached the part where that's economically feasible, although maybe in 10 years or 20 years it might be. Yeah, right. Now, if you ask, but let me continue along this line. If you ask, well, what did the bacteria do to actually affect this macroscopic change in the pattern? Well, the answer is they essentially converted themselves into like a liquid crystal. So here is the bacteria under their normal branching phase over here, if you look at it, and they look like normal, I don't know if you've ever seen normal bacteria, they're sort of, you know, like this shaped over here, they have an aspect ratio of a couple to one, or 4 to 5 to 1 or something. So they're not symmetric, but they're not too far from spherical. Whereas over here, the bacteria have suppressed their ability to divide, so they grow longer and longer without dividing, and they make themselves into rods that have about five times higher aspect ratio over here than over here. So there's some change that has suppressed cell division, made them much longer. This thing has the effect of creating something that behaves much more like a liquid crystal. So now there's some type of orientational order parameter that has to be taken into account in the dynamics that was not taken into account before. And you can do that, and Eschel did that. So here is, for example, well, just to show you a picture of what it looks like, well, if it runs. That's a picture of them, and you see now the motion here is actually, you know, these things are now long molecules, and they tend to move, you know, pretty much constrained. They don't sort of go every which direction. Their motion now is really constrained by the fact that they're much longer. So you can take into account, you know, some orientational order parameter and create a model of this, and it sort of works, but I should say, so you can build a model of this, and you can explain this pattern on its own, you know, regard. If you knew the bacteria were that long, and you measured their motion, you can create a model of this pattern using ideas from like liquid crystals and orientational order parameters. But what's really missing is understanding how this transition worked. Because this transition reflects somehow some coupling between the dynamics of the colony and some type of gene expression dynamics or mutation, maybe gene expression dynamics. So somehow the genes that are being expressed here are different than the ones here. This somehow created a change in the pattern, and it's all coupled together in some way that we just don't understand. Yes.
Bacteria.
They're not the different bacteria. Sorry. They're it's a reversible change.
As the pattern develops.
Yes. They're the same bacteria. How could it be anything other than a mutation? Is that the Because gene expression can be
at some point,
yes. Yes.
A new kind of,
right.
That looks like that,
emerges. Right.
As it
grows. Right. Right. So the answer is that, these are not deterministic systems. So imagine these things are growing out, and that there's some probability for either mutation or switching the state of the gene expression pattern, such that
Switching the state.
Yes.
The way it's transmitted.
Yes, that's inheritable. That's heritable. Yes.
What's heritable is the gene.
No, the pattern of gene expression can also be heritable.
That's controlled eventually by the gene.
The question is, what determines that pattern? That's what he said.
That pattern has memory. In other words, you can put something into some state, and it will, yes. They can remember. The answer is they can still be in that state. There are epigenetic inheritance mechanisms. Yes.
Could there just be some genetically controlled switch that the organism has to take advantage of different kinds of environments?
Right.
And when you put it in a different environment, it goes to all these different aspects.
Yes, but then. Right. So that's. But now the question is then, how do you inherit that? And the answer is you can inherit that as a dynamic state. In other words, that genetic switch, what is it really? It's some concentrations of proteins in the cell that give you a particular state of the gene expression pattern.
So the genetic code tells you if you're in this condition or this way, if you're in that condition,
then
it's
not.
Yes. 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 Yes.
And put it in a new condition, it doesn't start growing the old pattern. It keeps on going with the
power. Right. It can.
So once it gets into that.
It remembers it. There's clear.
The opposite transition is also.
Yes, you can have the opposite transition also.
Yeah, if I may add a little bit.
Are we going to get to?
It's really different from what ordinary people observe. Because most of the experiments are usually done on bacteria that don't interact. This is group behavior. What seems, and there is a microbiologist that will walk you, and we also work with a very simple technique. It seems that what happens
That's the statement.
Is a collective gene expression, or cooperative gene expression. Today, once there is this gene expression, it also emits chemical that helps to lock into this specific time. But it's not that
he said he moved a single bacteria, not a
group. No.
It's part of the semantic. What the biologists call mutation is a change.
But the real answer is it's not really known.
Because this doesn't, it's not hard. Because always they make the position. Now, if it is a change in the sequence or not, we don't know.
We just don't know. So
it's not very likely that it's changing the sequence as usually they supposed to do, because this requires some more or longer time of exposure.
But if it isn't the changing the sequence, I don't understand how you take one of these.
No, no.
When you take one, it doesn't mean one. It's not really one.
It's probably a few.
You don't take a single one. Usually, but it depends on, well, maybe after the topic.
Yes, right. No, so the point is that this is not understood. So exactly, I mean, you know, you're asking all the right questions, but, you know, we don't.
There is a process of this kind, so it took a long time and they saw that all this is an artifact. Or this is going uncontrolled by logic.
Okay, that's philosophy, but anyway, the point is that whatever this is, on a microscopic level, this is some way in which, my point was, just to get back to my, was this is some way in which the bacteria, rather than being, you know, just spectators in the pattern and participants with no say, are somehow have internal degrees of freedom that they can turn on, switch on in some way, whatever those internal degrees of freedom actually are, which then macroscopically affect the pattern. Yes. Yes.
Can they be induced purposely? Is there a way to
actually... If you change, so, I mean, the answer is, at least at the most gross level, there are various conditions of the surface that seem to prefer one type of growth versus...
Okay, so you put a bunch of...
You can see the reverse transition.
So that makes it very unlikely.
You showed it in the previous slide, induced transition. That's what was induced transition.
No, no, he's asking about the reverse. He's asking the reverse.
Yes, you go to different conditions.
Yeah, right, so I, right. Okay. Okay, good. Now, so the example I was showing you, you can think of as being a two-level system. Two-level meaning the colony level and the bacteria level, where the bacteria have dynamics in their scale, the gene expression or genome or whatever it is, and and then they interact globally in some way to create the colony pattern. But that, of course, leads you to the question of, can you make a three-level system? Well, here's the most intriguing possibility to date. This is called a vortex pattern. Now, why is it called a vortex pattern? Well, this is, again, the same Petri dish, but now these bright dots on the end here are new players in the game. They're organized vortices, so they rotate, you'll see that in a second, where, you know, depending on exactly what species or whatever, these things have their own existence as a collective phenomena, but they also are the things that are creating the whole pattern. So now there are sort of three levels of organization here. There's the individual bacteria level, there's creating these vortices, and now the pattern as a whole is created by these vortices moving out along the surface, interacting with each other and perhaps with the cells left behind over here, and creating something which is arguably a more complex pattern. Now, this vortex here is just a slight close-up of it, and I'll show you a better one in a second. This is what it looks like if you just look a little more closely. This is sort of left bacteria left behind. This is some rotating mass of cells. Now, this is a new structure. This is not bacteria. I'll tell you this in a second. So it turns out that unlike the branching pattern and the chiral pattern, where we had some non-living system analogs to fall back on to begin our thinking about, it turns out that when we got to this, when the field got to this vortex pattern, there was no non-living analog out there to try to sort of fall back on. So we had to actually retreat and just ask the general question, forget now about the bacteria colony, what is this vortex structure? So it turns out this vortex structure is pretty general. This is not a bacteria. This is actually a eukaryotic amoeba. I'll just run this again. This is from the laboratory of Eberhard Bodenschatz. This is a couple of hundred of these amoeba forming this rotating state over there. And you can try to understand it using, so now we have to go back and do some more physics because we don't have anything we can directly plug into our consciousness. So what is the physics, and in fact, why was this not seen in living systems? Well, it turns out that there's an interesting notion that's come up, which is sometimes called flocking or sometimes called the interaction of self-propelled particles, which is that living cells, unlike normal particles, you know, they live in a world, first of all, which is inertia-dominated, that's obvious, which is not inertia-dominated, which is this, which is viscosity, dissipation dominated, that's obvious, but they also have their own motors, their own sources of energy that they can use to move. So you have bacteria or amoeba or birds or fish or whatever that have internal sources of energy that they can convert into motion in a variety of ways, and from the point of view of energy conservation, they don't care which way they're going, they just move. But now you can ask, what happens if I have a collection of these self-propelled objects, I put them all together, they have some type of attractive force holding them together, and we know what that is in the amoeba system, it's just cell-cell adhesion. We don't quite know what it is in the bacterial system, although we think it's related to the fact that there are signals that the bacteria emit that they themselves then are attracted to. And you put that all together and you ask, what does that do? So here's a simple physical model of this new type of Newton's laws of motion where, you know, particles interact with hard cores and attractive interactions, but this term over here enforces a typical speed for the particle. So think of it like bumper cars. You're in the amusement park, everybody is in their bumper car, everybody puts their foot as far down to the ground as they can to give themselves as fast a speed as possible, and now everybody goes, and what happens? Well, here's a simulation starting from some totally arbitrary initial conditions, which has to run. So putting in some very simple interactions between, you know, that things are, you know, have some attractive force, so they don't just fly apart, but of course they have some hardcore repulsion, and then just some simple rules and the variety of rules about how they coordinate their velocities with each other. And I said there's a field that's sort of come up trying to explain this sort of called flocking behavior, and you can try, you know, my equation has disappeared, you can try to analyze this and do various things, and a lot more work is needed to be done on this because this is new. In fact, one of the talks we had at our workshop was about observations of this new type of structure in plankton. Okay. Yes.
What were the boundary conditions? I mean, what stopped them?
The fact that they have some attractive force. So, you know, if you put it far, it's what? Yeah, they're bound. Yeah, it's just bound. And, you know, in the real system, in the amoeba, the attractive force is really the cells like to stick to each other. And so if one wanders far away, it will go away forever. But as long as they don't wander far away, they'll just form a self-bound vortex. And there are interesting features such as that we don't completely understand. Just from a physics perspective, there seems to be a size limitation in the simplest models to these vortices, that you can't make an arbitrarily big vortex. It will make a transition from this vortex state to a flock state where everybody will just form some type of missile-looking thing and just move in a straight line. And exactly, you know, is that transition always there? Does it depend on the nature of the forces? That's the type of non-equilibrium physics that needs to be done for this problem. And there's some, you know, and work is being done on it. Now, so if you think about this vortex pattern now going back, so this is, you know, purely the vortex pattern, the closest thing in the non-living world, although I don't know if you'd call it non-living world, is traffic patterns, where, you know, there are work about, yeah, I know about traffic patterns. I woke up at 4 a.m. today so that it would take me 3 hours instead of 6 hours to get here from San Diego. So now, once you go back and place this in the larger context of the bacterial colony patterns, there are a couple of questions that we don't know the answers to, which are all sort of interesting. One question is, we have this macroscopic pattern, which is formed from these vortices. Can I make a model of the macroscopic pattern that just treats the vortices as some, you know, new type of collective excitation of the original system, write down equations of motion for those vortices, and get things that agree with the experiment and make predictions that I can test? Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, no one has really tried to do that very much. And, you know, but clearly these vortices do interact with each other. Are vortices fixed, or somehow the different types of macroscopic patterns give rise to different types of vortices? somehow do behavior, do we have to go back and think about single bacteria anymore? Do bacteria somehow know if they're inside the vortex, not inside the vortex? There are just many questions that are a little fuzzy, but really amount to the question of how are we going to model the system? Are we going to model the system in terms of two levels, just interacting vortices that make a macroscopic pattern, and then as a separate problem, we're going to understand how vortices form? That's sort of like, you know, understanding, you know, atoms from the Schrodinger equation and then going off and doing fluid mechanics. We never have to compare those two ends. We know that the atoms will form, and then we know that we can treat them as individual entities when we do fluid mechanics, or is it something more complicated? And I think we just need to investigate the system to really find out. So that leads to the question I showed you 2 and 3, and you know the usual statement is 2, 3, infinity. So, you know, this is for the astrophysicists in the audience. This is just one version of a familiar joke, which maybe some of you know, which has to do with the structure of the universe. And someone has just given a talk about the latest advances in astronomy, and someone comes up and says, you know, you have it all wrong. The universe is sitting on the back of a giant turtle. And the scientist asks, well, what is that turtle on? And another even larger turtle. And then the answer is, well, you can't fool me. It's turtles all the way down. Now, translated into what I want to tell you, the question is, well, how many interacting levels can there be in a complicated biological system? Well, the answer is, you know, sort of, it's almost mind-boggling, because let me give you just some random facts that are connected to the problem in ways that we don't completely understand. But, for example, there's a whole bunch of work on the details of how these bacteria actually sense the nutrient level, the interacting, yes, here? Oh, sorry. The ways in which they communicate with each other via these chemotactic chemicals. So if you ask how they sense these things, the answer is, well, of course they have proteins on their surface. These proteins bind the molecules. But as we're learning from experiments in Howard Berg's lab and models of that process in great detail, we're learning that the idea of treating this thing as a simple system is just wrong. These proteins interact with each other. They modulate each other. The system behaves as, again, some complicated dynamical system where via the complicated interaction it enables it to have a much larger dynamic range than it otherwise would have, a much higher sensitivity. So the level of just the receptor, the sensor itself, is also a complicated dynamical system. Genes. Well, we usually think of genes as just static memory, but there are a variety of features in bacteria that really indicate that the genome itself is not static. The thing I like the best is this amazing thing that I promised myself one of these years I will understand, called bacterial genetic competence, which is the fact that bacteria, bacteria colonies, of course, you know, there are the unlucky ones that die. The ones that die, lice, which means they dump all their contents into the soup. And, of course, their contents include DNA. And then other bacteria sometimes, and the sometimes is controlled by a very complicated series of signals between the bacteria, but sometimes they go into the soup and soak up the DNA and apparently use it to recombine with their own DNA as a way to vary their genetic information. The understanding of this is very primitive. Things that are understood are, for example, the fact that this is not always done. It requires some specific signals. It's not, you know, for a while people thought the bacteria were just eating the DNA, and it turns out that doesn't make any sense. They didn't make any sense to me ever, but you know, they have a very specialized machinery for taking the DNA and sort of protecting it from all the various things that would degrade it in order to sort of bring it to its own DNA. So it's hard to believe it's just eating it and going through all that effort to just eat it. And exactly how it does this or why it does this is a total mystery. But, you know, this is part of the same story. The bacteria have a repertory of tricks, dynamic systems that they can call into play that can even do things like recombine their genomes. And in fact, this picture is a picture of using transposing elements, and we'll talk about that. Now, this is the philosophy slide because I don't know what to say. So, you know, the only way we can deal with this problem, I mean, we only can deal with it step by step. There's no choice. We can't, you know, do everything at once. So we work on each of these individual levels and create models that can somehow, you know, need whatever dynamics seem to be relevant for a given type of thing that we see. And, you know, what we hope, though, is that somehow, you know, understanding the way these things are organized will help us really understand how these systems work in a way. We know these systems do things that are rather interesting, you know, which, you know, here are the buzzwords of the decade in terms of this field. They're flexible yet robust, whatever that means. We know what it means roughly, but we don't know what it means precisely. So perhaps this is part of the key, is that instead of having a sort of fixed dynamics that they always do and suffer the consequences, they have these sort of multiple levels of things they can try, and eventually that gives them much more flexibility in order for dealing with stress. And I stress again that all these things are revealed when you do experiments that sort of push them into revealing what they have to do in order to survive. If you just give them a cushy life, they'll just sit around and not do very much. Okay. And as I said, the bacteria flourish for billions of years. We need them, but they don't need us. Okay, so the last reason of why to do theory, I'm almost done, a lot of questions, is, you know, the last couple of notions are very squishy, and it would be nice if we knew what those notions were that was not squishy. I think it's, you know, anybody, if you force them to make a decision looking at the vortex patterns versus the simple branching patterns, you would clearly get, I claim, you know, universal agreement that somehow the vortex patterns are more complex, but we have no idea what that actually means in terms of any quantitative measure. And so what is it? How do you what is robustness of flexibility? You know, and also you might think of, you know, is there a non-living system that behaves like this sort of three level? In honor of our, this is 3T for three turtles, it could also be T3 in honor of our recall election. Okay, so I'm done. What I wanted to tell you was that biological systems do offer new challenges. I mean, you know, I mean, they're built on the same physics and phenomena and mechanisms that we have come to understand or can be understood by doing non-equilibrium physics, but how it all sort of works together is still pretty much a mystery, and, you know, this is the sort of leading edge of that mystery for this particular case. Experiments really should be designed that actually, you know, help you sort of unravel these different levels of feedback. Just, you know, fully quantitative models are practical impossibilities. So what you do instead is you make these sort of schematic models, and schematic models have a sort of a, you know, schizophrenic existence. On the one hand, they're always wrong, because, you know, a schematic model such as, you know, if I make a model of all my bacteria to be these sort of simple walkers that have these orientation interactions to make a vortex, I get the existence of vortices, but then I totally miss the fact that the vortices can organize themselves on a larger scale into the pattern of the colony. But that's okay. That just means that, you know, I have to understand what the model is trying to do. I can't just say one model is going to be the answer, because the system has new dynamics that I have to take into account whenever my experiment reveals conditions under which those dynamics become non-trivial. On the other hand, if you tried to do this without schematic models, you wouldn't make any progress at all. You'd have no way of understanding why you have a vortex, no way of understanding why you get branches, or you wouldn't have any way to even get started thinking about the hard problems in the system. So I'm done. That's left over from Eshel. Yes, David.
Are there a whole lot of new patterns?
Oh, you mean case? Well, so for example, one thing which is, so it depends how, so patterns, so for example, in another field, which is, you know, calcium dynamics of intracellular systems, what has been discovered is something which you can now probably mimic in a chemistry experiment, but which was originally, from my perspective, discovered in the biological system, which is a system that has nonlinear waves, you know, some type of, like, you know, think about nonlinear waves like flames propagating in the forest or something, but because the system is so small, you can actually get nucleation of those waves. So you're dealing with waves inside a single cell. The underlying fluctuations of channels opening and closings are enough to allow repeated nucleation of those waves, and that creates new things that had not previously been seen in the physical system. And now people, so now what you do is, there are people who are trying to go back to physical systems, for example, some of these chemical reactors, now artificially add large amounts of noise, much larger than what thermal noise would be, in order to see whether one can generically understand that class. So that's a class that comes from the biological system, but then you go back and write down equations and you try to find a physical analog because you can make more quantitative progress doing that. So that's another example in my own work where that's come up. Let me think if I can think of any others offhand. I probably can think of some others, but you know, it's a mixture. I mean, sometimes you come across the same basic schema, you know, schematic that we saw in the physical world. And you know, for example, in electrical waves in heart tissue, it depends. I mean, there, it's hard to be sure, but there, all the 2D phenomena that people see in heart tissues, so you take a heart and you slice a piece of tissue, put it in a dish and look at it as a 2D pattern, all those things have been seen before in physical systems. On the other hand, there are people who have argued that what happens in a three-dimensional heart, because of the way the heart is sort of dynamically organized in terms of its symmetries, is different than what has ever been seen before in a three-dimensional isotropic material. That's still a hypothesis, because people don't really know for sure what's going on in the heart. It's hard to image three-dimensional heart tissue. So there, you know, the two-dimensional phenomena had been seen before, but when you go to 3D, there are some new things that seem to happen that had not been seen before.
So that's all in the nature of extending the parameter. So if you extend the parameter range and there's tremendous diversity, you expect to see new phenomena.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I owe David the answer to your question. It took us about 5 years because you ask how can a single bacterium, you and Tony, can maintain a memory which is not in the sequence. Why it's not in the sequence, we think. We don't have the entire sequence. We sequence the 16S RNA, which is used to identify bacteria, and it looks the same. The point that should be kept in mind, that the chiral one are not only longer, but they have about 4 or 5 replication of the chromosome, where the other bacteria have one replication. So the picture that we have in mind is that once they have the 4 or 5 replications, it's like having a single bacterium is like a number of bacterium that can lock the gene expression. And indeed, you can reverse it back to the simple one, but to make the transition from the chiral to the branching is much harder, and you need much more limited space of parameter that can enable you to do it. So that's the current picture that we have right now.
Let's thank the speaker again.